Well, just 7 years after the Bread and Roses strike, another massive walkout became a major turning point in the American labor movement. September 9th, 1919, the Boston Police went on strike, the first ever strike by a public employees union. Several years ago, I met up with James Green, a professor of history and labor studies at UMass Boston, and a walking, talking encyclopedia of the working history of Boston. We visited two of the most important sites of the 1919 police strike, a pub in the South End, and the old armory on Arlington Street in downtown Boston. Yes, it's that building that looks like a castle, but is now an event space. This was one of the most important spots in the 1919 police strike. Why is that? What happened here?
Well, this was the headquarters of the First Corps of Cadets, a colonial militia, very elite group of people who sent units to the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. And after the Civil War, it became a kind of club for the Brahmins, well-to-do, highly educated people, and didn't really see much action. But they kept a militia unit that could be organized in emergency, and the police strike was such an emergency. And so when disorder spread in the streets, this building became a kind of beehive of military activity, and it did. World War One had just ended. Many of these men had served in the military in World War One, so they thought, well, we're having a domestic war on the streets. Actually, the police were behaving in a very peaceful way, but there was disorder and rioting and high anxiety.
So take me back to 1919. I mean, it's post-World War One, as you said. America is victorious in that war. But what was life in Boston like, and specifically actually for the police?
The war was a war to end wars, a war to save democracy in the world. And so working people were asked to make great sacrifices during the war. No wage increase. The Boston police hadn't had a raise in 5 years, which is one of the issues they had. Of course, wartime inflation was enormous, so this was the context.
I understand that the cost of living rose something like 76% over the time of the war.
Yeah, it did. And they had no mechanism for bargaining for wages. It was just simply, this is your wage. It set the police commissioner. His name was Edwin Upton Curtis. He was from a Yankee family, had very little contact with Irish Catholic working class people who composed the workforce. And he, 1919 was a frightening year. There were a lot of strikes. There was a fear of communism. It was a great Red Scare. And he was determined to keep control of his men and to be the boss.
I've seen a picture of him. He's got that classic handlebar mustache, but he was a pretty hard-headed guy.
He was, and the previous commissioner was someone, he was Irish himself and had a very good rapport with the police officers. But when Curtis came in, a lot of other things were going on. The police had been meeting in what they called a social club and had put some demands together. They were working a 60-hour work week and no raise in 5 years. They had to buy their own uniforms. They didn't get paid when they went to court. They didn't get paid when they stayed overnight at the station. So they wanted to talk to him about changing all this. And he refused. And then they'd start talking about forming a union. And he told them that was prohibited. That they denied them the right. And they said, that's our freedom of association under the Constitution. And he said, I'm sorry, you're public servants. You do not have that right.
So what exactly happened during the police strike at this spot where we're standing?
The governor, Calvin Coolidge, newly elected Republican governor, sent out the Metro Police Force to help. But he didn't send out the National Guard, which was crucial. The police commissioner had been promised that if there was a police strike, the National Guard would be here to preserve order in the streets. And Coolidge waited for 3 days to send in the National Guard. By then, some fairly serious violence had occurred. The media had turned completely against the police, not only blamed them for all the violence, but accused them of being in sympathy with the Russian Bolsheviks. This is the attitude that was prevailing during the Red Scare.
And in fact, as you mentioned, sort of the national media was looking at Boston at the time. I mean, I was reading in what was then the Philadelphia Public Ledger, they wrote that Bolshevism in the United States is no longer a specter. Boston in chaos reveals its sinister substance.
Yes. Yeah, the only way these journalists interpreted this, which seems bizarre in retrospect, is that Irish Catholic police officers were somehow inspired by the Russian Bolsheviks. I mean, but that's kind of the way that people were thinking at the time.
Although we do have to remember the Bolshevik Revolution was very fresh in everyone's
memory.
It had just occurred.
And in fact, in 1919, the Comintern, Lenin had formed this worldwide organization to send out agents. And there was a lot of fear of communism. And by the way, Sacco and Vanzetti had been arrested that spring, and anarchists suspected of putting bombs in people's houses. So there were a lot of things for people to be afraid of. And they were afraid of the police because they thought, well, maybe they're part of this now. So Coolidge waited for 3 days and finally sent in ordered out the National Guard. And the First Corps of Cadets was based here, the motor unit of the militia. So this was, as I said, a beehive of military activity. There's some of our public servants going to work right now. There's a fire station right down the street. So once the militia came in, some of them were seasoned veterans, some of them were very green National Guardsmen, and there was some fairly serious crowd activity and rioting in South Boston. And they were threatened by a crowd, and they fired into the crowd and killed 3 citizens, which made South Boston enraged. And that still isn't forgotten there, by the way. It was kind of a strange replay of the Boston Massacre of 1770.
In 1919.
and people saw it that way.
Do you want to walk a little bit more towards...
I'll show you a plaque that was erected here by the First Corps of Cadets when this building became a national landmark.
So here we are.
Yeah,
we're right at the right at the front door of the Smith and Wolensky restaurant. And actually, if you didn't know this plaque was here, you could usually just breeze right by
it. You would miss it. Yeah, I mean, I wonder how many restaurant goers notice it. But there it is, and it tells you the story of the building. The Armory was financed by the citizens of Boston, various military orders, historical societies, and the city of Boston. During the police strike of 1919, the First Corps acted as Boston's sole force to uphold law and order.
So, Professor Green, you know, the very fact, I find it significant that this is all happening right after World War One. I mean, 1919, the Great War ends in 1918. And Governor Coolidge goes so far, as I can understand, at calling the men who went on strike here, the police officers, traitors.
Yes, yes, yeah. Traitors to the city and to service. I think that many people viewed the police, including Governor Coolidge, as a civilian version of the military.
Hearing the governor call them deserter and traitors really wounded their pride because so many of them were veterans
from the First World War. Yes, yes.
And that they even, you know, sort of came up with this rallying response. I found a quote here where they said, "Not one man of us ever disgraced the flag or his service. It is bitter to come home and be called deserters and traitors. Right. We are the same men who were on the French front. Some of us fought in the Spanish War in 1898. Won't you tell the people of Massachusetts in which war you served?"
That's right. I don't think Coolidge did serve, yes. So that left a bitter memory in the communities where these people lived and worked because they were the cops on the beat. So when this happened to them, it really sent a message that people didn't forget.
A memory that still lives because many of those men were grandfathers of folks who still live here.
You can still go into places in the South Boston and hear about my grandfather who was a policeman and lost his job, and there's still hard feelings about it.
All right, well, so that's what happened here at the Armory, but you want to take us to another spot that's
significant
to the strike.
Yes, I want to take you to Fay Street in the South End.
So this is the corner of Dover and Fay Street?
Fay Street, yeah. This is now Berkeley Street. They changed the name of it, I think, because Dover Street was associated with an immigrant ghetto. Mary Anton, a great writer, wrote a book about growing up here and rising out of the ghetto called The Promised Land. It became kind of a minor classic.
Things changed so much as an O2 yoga center here.
Yeah, I know, yeah. So this Foley's Pub, until recently, I don't know if it's still there. I think probably not. There was a photograph of Samuel Gompers hanging over the bar, who was the president of the American Federation of Labor. And right in this alley here, we'll walk down there. I'll show you where the police met. Let's just see if this is open. You know, it might be.
Oh, there's a plaque here, too, actually. Oh, It was just placed here in 2009.
Oh my gosh, so this is new to me. I didn't even see it.
So right outside of J.J. Foley's cafe, once pub, there's a relatively new plaque commemorating the Boston police strike.
Yes, look at this. 2009, erected by the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. No surprise there. Their parent group met here, you know, in 1919. And on this site at Dover and Fay Streets was the original location of the Boston Social Club, which was chartered by the American Federation of Labor August 15th, 1919, as a local to represent Boston police patrolmen. On August 26th, Union President John F. McGinnis and 18 of his newly elected union representatives were suspended by the police commissioner for forming a union in violation of department rules. September 9th, 1919, at 5:45, 1,117 Boston patrolmen left their posts in support of their leaders and went on strike. The rest of the plaque reads,
3 days of rioting ensued, ending only after a call-up of the National Guard. None of the striking police officers were ever rehired. So, at the Old Armory, we see one plaque showing the one side of the story. Here at J.J. Foley's pub, or cafe, we see the other side of the story of the 1919 strike in another in another plaque.
Well, this is what you call a place of memory. A place of memory, the Armory, for the elites of Boston who saw themselves as the guardians of law and order. And here, a place of memory for the working class people who saw themselves as the guardians of law and order. So, two versions of the same story.
I suppose the important thing to note, though, as you were saying, is that the Boston police in 1919, they lost.
They did. It was they lost the strike. They lost their jobs. And the cause of public employee unionism was set back many, many decades. It's not clear that what would have happened if they'd won, if other public servants were starting to think about organizing, but were trying to do it, the firefighters and the teachers. But after this, the door was closed until really the 1970s took that long.
It just occurs to me that, you know, history does echo the present day, because we're a nation which is still at war. In 1919, it was post-war time. Uncertain economy. Mm-hmm. There's this sense from political leadership, certain political leadership, that unions are, strangling the economies of states, if not the nation. Do you see similar echoes there?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure the public employees in Wisconsin are aware of this and see a direct line between what they're fighting for and what these men fought for in 1919, and all lost their jobs for that principle. I think from the point of view of working people who want unions, it's important to establish the point that you can talk and bargain, you don't always win. But the police in 1919 never even got a chance to talk about their conditions and lost everything. And that may be what will happen to 1,000 people tomorrow in Wisconsin.
Do you have any family connection to the police strike?
Not to the police strike. No, I'm actually, my family ties are in Wisconsin, so I'm from a union family from Oshkosh. My grandmother belonged to a garment unit workers union. I got an email from my cousin in Madison, who's a Catholic nun, and she said, "You won't believe what's going on out here. What would Grandma think?"
What would your grandma think?
Well, she would have been very unhappy with all this, because she was a very proud member of her union before she married my grandfather and had 7 children.
Wow.
Including my father.
Well, Professor Green, thank you so much for giving us this tour, not only of history, but also how history lives in neighborhoods around Boston.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guide, UMass Boston labor historian James Green. We spoke back in 2011 amid the battle between Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and that state's public employee unions. And this sad note, Professor Green passed away in June of this year from complications of leukemia. He was 71. Well, when we come back, when Massachusetts workers walked off the job in support of their boss. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.